KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
My whole team was cut, so we don't know what will happen because there's no statisticians left in our center.
That's one of the thousands of Health and Human Services staffers who got fired this morning in a massive shakeup at the agency.
It's Tuesday, April 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ahead this hour, what mass layoffs at HHS could mean for public health.
Also, the son of the ousted leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, on why charges against his mother should be dropped.
I'm calling for her to be freed, along with all the other political prisoners, and for the country to be returned to its democratically elected government.
And how the new TV drama Adolescence broke Netflix streaming records.
I think it is the most nuanced and complex portrait of middle school boys I've ever seen.
Plus, the latest from Istanbul, where an imprisoned presidential candidate is sparking protests.
After the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has ended a more than 25-hour floor speech, the longest in Senate history. It beats the old record held by then-Democrat Strom Thurmond, who spoke out against the Civil Rights Act and segregation in 1957. Booker mentioned that record and the man behind it, but said that while there's room in the Senate building named for Thurmond, he realizes the reason for his own marathon speech.
Maybe my ego got too caught up that if I stood here, maybe I could break this record. But the man who tried to stop the rights upon which I stand. I'm not here, though, because of his speech. I'm here despite his speech. I'm here because as powerful as he was, the people were more powerful.
Thurmond's record was set 68 years ago. Booker spent much of his own speech deriding the Trump administration's cuts to the federal workforce and noting concerns about the safety of Social Security and other safety net programs. A federal judge has denied the Trump administration's request to have Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil's legal case heard in Louisiana. As NPR's Adrian Florido reports, he's being held there while the government tries to deport him on accusations his pro-Palestinian activism aligns with Hamas terrorism.
After arresting Mahmoud Khalil in New York on March 8th, immigration agents quickly sent him to a detention center in New Jersey. His lawyer didn't know that, so the next morning she filed suit in New York. Hours later, the government flew Khalil to Louisiana and has been trying to get his legal case transferred there. Louisiana's federal courts are among the nation's most conservative. Now a judge in New Jersey has ruled his case will stay in New Jersey because that's where he was when his lawyer first challenged his detention. His lawyers are now asking the judge to free Khalil while his case moves forward, or at least have him sent back from Louisiana. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Leaders from rural communities are pushing Congress to unfreeze grant funding for climate and environmental projects that have been frozen by the Trump administration. NPR's Michael Copley reports they told lawmakers those investments could deliver big economic benefits.
Tom Atkinson runs the Kotzebue Electric Association in Alaska, a federal grant supposed to help the community pay for batteries to store electricity, cutting down how much diesel fuel has to be shipped in to run generators. But the money was frozen after President Trump took office. And the people in Atkinson's community are in a bind.
They just want the lights to go on. They want the rates to be affordable. We can't continue to do that without continued support.
Atkinson's one of dozens of leaders from rural communities who came to Washington looking for help. A spokesperson for Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said she's working on getting grants unfrozen. The Energy Department didn't respond to messages seeking comment. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Another day of mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow was down 11 points. The Nasdaq closed up 150 points today. You're listening to NPR. Sales of new vehicles during the first quarter of this year may have gotten a last-minute boost from the threat of coming Trump administration tariffs. General Motors says its sales for the first 3 months of the year rose 17%, driven in part by demand for its affordable crossover models. Ford saw sales slip slightly. Sales of electric vehicles rose more than 19%, according to Ward's Intelligence. Planned 25% levies on imported vehicles coming into the U.S. are set to start this week. Will likely reduce the number of low-cost options for consumers at a time the average price of a new vehicle is nearly $50,000. The rapper Playboi Carti has the number one album in the U.S., but he had to fend off a serious challenger. NPR's Stephen Thompson has more.
Last week, Playboi Carti dominated the Billboard charts. His new album Music debuted at number one, while all 30 of its songs landed on the Billboard Hot 100 simultaneously. This week, Playboi Carti had stiff competition from the singer Selena Gomez, whose new album with producer and fiancé Benny Blanco is called I Said I Love You First. The two albums were neck and neck, but in the end, I Said I Love You First debuts at number two, leaving Playboi Carti on top of the charts for a second straight week. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices edged lower today with traders bracing for the possible effects of Trump administration tariffs that will be going into effect tomorrow. Oil fell 28 cents a barrel to settle at $71.20 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration keeps eliminating federal government jobs. Today, thousands of workers at federal health agencies across the country found out they were being fired. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is here in the studio to talk about it. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
So who's leading this effort to lay off employees in Health and Human Services?
It is part of the DOGE effort to shrink the federal workforce. Last Thursday, Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced plans to dramatically overhaul the department he oversees and cut the workforce by a total of 20,000 employees. That's wow. Almost 25% of staff. There was a loose outline of how it would go. Kennedy said it would focus on streamlining administrative work, but not a lot of detail, so everyone was really holding their breath. Staff expected notices to go out on Friday, but they didn't. Over the weekend, nothing. Yesterday, nothing. Then today, around 5 a.m., reduction in force or RIF emails started to come in.
And how did the day unfold?
Well, some people woke up to the news in their inboxes. Some didn't, so they headed into work. And at several buildings, there were lines of workers snaking around the block. Many found out they had been fired when they tried to badge into the building and their badge didn't work. Jennifer Hainig's whole team was cut. She's a statistician who oversees a national survey on drug use and health. She saw the email early this morning before going to work in Rockville, Maryland, but she says not everyone did.
Like someone on my team specifically, he was able to badge in like normal. And then he went upstairs and got the RIF notice.
She says there was someone going around to the offices who told him to leave. Another source of mine thought she was okay. Her badge worked. She was at her desk. And then she got an email that said even though she hadn't gotten a notice, she should take her laptop and, quote, exit the building as soon as possible. NPR's not naming her because she feared retaliation for speaking publicly.
Do you have a sense of who was being cut, whether it fits into any pattern?
Well, we know what HHS told us last week, but nothing more. They're not answering more follow-up questions. And part of that might be because they're cutting communications teams across HHS. What NPR's health team does know has been pieced together by sources. The picture is honestly pretty confusing. I mean, there were cuts in tobacco regulation, rare disease research, HIV prevention, fertility research, occupational safety, utility assistance for low-income people, and more. A few very high-ranking NIH directors were given an offer to transfer to the Indian Health Service and given the option of several remote posts. Even people working on chronic diseases were cut, even though Kennedy says that's part of his new focus to make Americans healthier.
You've been talking to HHS staff all day. What have you heard?
I'm hearing sadness, confusion, tears, a lot of anger. Let me tell you one story. Scott Laney has worked for CDC for almost 20 years. He's based in Morgantown, West Virginia.
I work as an epidemiologist for the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program, which does surveillance of chest radiographs for black lung in coal miners.
I reached him today at home, and he was absolutely shell-shocked. Nearly everyone in his center, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, was cut. They do things like evaluate face mask safety, firefighter deaths on the job, and more. Their whole building in Morgantown is set up for this specialized scientific work, and he says it's now just going to sit there empty. He got choked up talking about colleagues with young families, one coworker who's pregnant and due in 6 weeks, worrying about her health insurance running out.
It's just absolutely heartbreaking, and at the same time realizing that I've lost my own job. And I don't know what I'm going to do.
And in just a sentence or two, what are Republicans saying about these cuts?
Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana invited Kennedy to come testify before the Health Committee next week to defend the reorganization and explain its goals.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, thank you.
Thank you.
The big earthquake last Friday in Myanmar is raising questions about whether that country's military rulers can hang on to power. Myanmar was already in dire shape before the earthquake, with a civil war in full swing. The quake is also raising questions about the fate of Aung San Suu Kyi. She is the ousted leader of Myanmar, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. She was arrested when the military seized power in a coup in 2021, and she has been in prison ever since. Well, her son, Kim Aris, is with me now in our studios here in Washington. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I want to ask, when was the last time you saw or spoke with your mother?
I spoke to her a couple of days before the coup. Since then, I've had only one letter from her.
When was that?
Almost 2 years ago now, I think, or just over 2 years ago.
Are you able to get messages to her in any way? Is her lawyer in contact?
I sent her letters and care packages, but since I received no reply, there's no way of knowing whether or not they get through. From what I understand, she hasn't been allowed to see her lawyers for at least a couple of years. And she's been held in solitary confinement.
Where is she?
Well, we believe in Naypyidaw prison. It's very hard to confirm anything. Near where the earthquake hit. So we're very concerned about her well-being, obviously. But it's very hard to confirm anything. I do know that she has ongoing health concerns.
She's 79?
That's right. She'll be 80 this year. And she's spent pretty much a quarter of her life incarcerated in one way or another.
The sentence that she is currently serving is 33 years on corruption and other charges. I will note that human rights groups have called those charges a sham. You are calling for them to be dropped?
Absolutely. I'm calling for her to be freed, along with all the other political prisoners, and for the country to be returned to its democratically elected government. The military have shown that they are incapable of ruling or leading their country in any way, and people will not accept it.
We mentioned the earthquake, a terrible event, obviously, with so many people killed and survivors desperate, even more desperate than they were for food, for medicine, for vital supplies. The quake has made what sounds like an already difficult situation in your country far more difficult.
Yes, the military have used natural disasters in the past to weaponize aid, and they're doing so again on this occasion, and they're still bombing innocent civilians at the same time. At the moment, they've cut off aid organizations getting to the most needy areas, and they're stopping journalists getting in.
We had the Myanmar country acting director for a major aid organization on the program yesterday, who was describing that his teams are able to move, they are getting access, but it's incredibly difficult and there is vast need for medical supplies. Acknowledging the horror of the situation, does it open any doors, any opportunities for a change in your mother's circumstances?
We can only hope, but at the moment there isn't any indication of that, and I haven't heard of what the results are of that earthquake in the prison, really. I've heard that she's safe, but there's no way of confirming that.
Hmm. I need to ask about a part of your mother's record. She won, as we said, the Nobel Peace Prize. She has also come under criticism for her response to the Rohingya crisis, for refusing to acknowledge the military's role in massacres.
That's incorrect. She never refused to acknowledge the military's role. She refused to condemn the military on the count of genocide. That's something else. But she always said the military were responsible for...
She defended the military at the International Court of Justice against allegations of genocide.
No, she wasn't defending the military. She was actually defending her country. That's something very different. She was working with the military, but not in any way against the Rohingya. She was always trying to do everything she could for the Rohingya, even before it came to the international community's attention. And the fact is that she was doing more for the Rohingya than anybody else in the world, which the media at the time failed to report on because it didn't fit their narrative.
Well, I will ask you, with no narrative or agenda, but just part of what has prompted criticism are the basic facts that there was a horrific exodus of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya across the border to Bangladesh. The Secretary General of the United Nations called what was happening in Myanmar ethnic cleansing. And your mother was the de facto leader. My question for you, did she ever express any regrets about how she handled that situation, whether she might have been able to do more?
I don't get to talk to my mother about political issues, really, since we only communicate over the phone often, and we know the military will be listening in. But I think, actually, she may have some regrets, but it wouldn't be the ones you think. She will be able to hold up her head and say she was doing everything she possibly could for the Rohingya. And if you read the evidence which is out there, I'm sure you would agree.
When were you last in Myanmar?
I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago, maybe.
Is that because you were not able to return because of security reasons?
Well, I wouldn't be able to go back now, certainly. But in the past, I generally go to Burma to see my mother, and she's been extremely busy, so I get to see her when I can.
You call your country Burma?
Yes.
In this moment, do you see a way out for Myanmar?
I do.
For how this war
despite
ends?
Despite the fact that the world is turning a blind eye to what's happening over there and is doing nothing to help, the military are losing, and they have the weaponry, the fighter planes, the backing of countries like China, Russia, and India. And still they're losing. They're not in control of even 70% of the country now. So I do see hope that the resistance will win, and soon.
Kim Aris is the son of imprisoned political leader Aung San Suu Kyi of Myanmar. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. To hear President Trump tell it, tariffs are perhaps the political equivalent of duct tape. You can use them to fix almost anything. For example, they are a negotiating tool. He used the threat of tariffs to pressure Canada and Mexico to implement border policies he liked. Tariffs are also a revenue source to Trump that might help offset his proposed $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. And in Trump's view, tariffs can be a shield to protect American manufacturing jobs from overseas competition. The thing is, tariffs can't actually be all of those things at once. And so, with tomorrow's planned announcement of even more tariffs, we wanted to try to answer a seemingly simple question. What is President Trump's goal with tariffs? For that, I'm joined by Rana Faruhar. She's a columnist for the Financial Times. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So a lot of people who've been critical of Trump's tariffs have pointed out these different stated purposes seem at odds with each other. Like, to raise revenue, you have to apply the tariffs long term, right? So then they're no longer a bargaining chip. And if tariffs are successful in getting companies to stop importing and they boost manufacturing in the US, well, then you're losing tariff revenue, right? So how does the Trump administration explain all these contradictions? Do they explain them?
Well, they haven't explained them well. And I think that that's one of the reasons that markets have actually been very jittery in the last few days and weeks. And just to step way back, I mean, this is an experiment that really hasn't been tried in 40, 50 years. So what we're talking about is a big change to the way the American economy and the global economy potentially works. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of reasons for it. I want to even caveat a little bit further before I get into those and say, you always have to count his psychology as part of the equation here.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because Trump often talks about his belief that the U.S. has been ripped off by other countries through their tariffs. Is that true?
It's hard to say ripped off when you look at how successful the U.S. is and rich compared to really any other country. That said, you could look at the tariff numbers themselves. Average U.S. tariffs on the rest of the world are around 2%. Europe, EU would be about 5%. China would be about 10%. So you could look at those numbers and say, something's not fair here. Maybe we need to rejigger things.
Well, that's interesting. Well, Trump describes trade deficits as subsidies that we are paying to other countries. Would you characterize it that way, subsidies?
I wouldn't look at it as subsidies, and I don't get quite as worked up about the actual trade balance as Trump and some of his advisors do. But what I would say is that we have kept tariffs very, very low and allowed a lot of countries access to the U.S. market with the idea that the way you make an economy work is by driving up stock prices and lowering consumer prices. And having a very, very open market has allowed that to happen. But there have also been ways in which domestic industries, critical minerals, semiconductors, electric vehicles, when you don't support those industries, they can go abroad. And then in times of crisis, you may regret that.
Trump did tell NBC over the weekend that he, quote, couldn't care less if automakers raise their prices. So if cost to consumers aren't his metric for success, then what do you think is his metric for success here?
So I think that there are a number of economic nationalists within the administration that see tariffs as a way to reindustrialize, as a way to bolster critical areas, not just the economy, but for security. Ships would be one good example. I mean, China's got about 5,500 seagoing vessels. America has a little over 180. That's a problem if you're in a war. But you have to do things at home and abroad if you want to actually support industries for economic or political or security reasons. And I don't see the home piece of this yet. I just see the tariff piece of it.
Rana Faruhar is a columnist for the Financial Times and the author of Homecoming, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That is people banging pots and pans outside their windows in Istanbul, a nightly show of support for pro-democracy protesters. Hundreds have been arrested at demonstrations in past weeks. They are calling for the release of an imprisoned presidential candidate and political rival of Turkey's president. Duri Buskerin reports.
In Turkey, most people aren't going to work the week after Ramadan. School's out, offices are closed. Gulizar Tunjer had planned a week of relaxing, seeing family. Instead, she's meeting with lawyers and visiting her 20-year-old son, Jana Güneş, in a high-security prison. They were marching against injustice and corruption, Tunjer says. They were there with their teachers and even escorted by police. 2 days after the protest, police arrested Güneş from his home in an early morning raid. He was charged with participating in an illegal demonstration outside Istanbul's city hall, which was attended by tens of thousands of people and many of his classmates. The whole point of these arrests is that it's intimidation, his mother says. That's why the arrests have turned into punishment. Güneş, a first-year student at Galatasaray University, has always felt strongly about human rights, his mother says. He planned to study philosophy. After years of sadness and despair in this country, they have become the voice of hope and resistance, Tunjer says. That's why the current powers have focused on the students. About 300 college students are among some 1,900 people arrested in connection with the protests since March 19th. Some were beaten during their arrest, suffering broken bones or injuries to their face, lawyers say. In a video posted to Instagram, attorney Bedia Büyük Gebiz is visibly upset after visiting student protesters in prison. They don't have basic necessities like pads or toothbrushes, she says. They're staying in the same cells as people accused of murder. Others were subject to strip searches for no apparent reason, she says. It's illegal, it goes against the Constitution, and it's against human dignity, Büyük Gebiz says. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his allies have insisted that the charges against jailed Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu are legitimate. On Sunday, Erdogan claimed that the opposition had, quote, lost their consciousness by targeting public safety and the economy in order to cover up the cycle of corruption and bribery. Selim Koru, a Turkish political expert and author based in London, says the administration extended the Ramadan holiday in the hopes that the protests would cool off.
They probably didn't anticipate this much noise, and they probably didn't anticipate this degree of organization on the opposition side.
Rallies in support of İmamoğlu have attracted hundreds of thousands of people. Tomorrow, protesters have called for a full boycott, asking people to buy absolutely nothing over the course of the day.
The idea that you and I go to the ballot box, we vote for somebody, and then that person represents us, that is sacred in Turkey. And if you disrupt that, people will, I think, remember.
The question is how long that momentum will last. For NPR News, I'm Duri Buskerin. Istanbul.
This is NPR News.
In a new movie, Paul Rudd and Jenna Ortega play a father and daughter. They drive deep into the wilderness and hit a unicorn with their car.
I wasn't sure if it was totally dead, and then I bludgeoned it with a tire iron just to put it out of its misery.
The movie is called Death of a Unicorn. Our conversation with Rudd and director Alex Sharfman tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, in courtrooms across the U.S., Justice Department lawyers have been defending President Trump's executive actions.
And in many cases, those lawyers have struggled to answer judges' questions.
The Justice Department is fast losing credibility before the courts.
That story coming up after this summary of the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker set a new record for longest floor speech in the history of the chamber, protesting the policies of the Trump administration for more than 24 hours straight. Meanwhile, a different Democratic Senator, Tim Kaine of Virginia, is calling on his Republican colleagues to help pass legislation tomorrow to curb President Trump's authority to impose new tariffs on key trading partner Canada. Kaine warning of the damage consumers and businesses could face if Congress doesn't stop it. He says Canada has already vowed to retaliate with tariffs on a variety of American goods.
They'll tax groceries and food products. They'll tax building supplies at a time when home prices are too high already. They will tax fertilizer to our farmers. About 80% of the potash that is used by our farmers for fertilizer comes from Canada.
And about 80% of the lumber used to build homes in the U.S. also comes from Canada. Leaders from rural communities are pushing Congress to unfreeze grant funding for climate and environmental projects that have been frozen by the Trump administration. NPR's Michael Copley reports they told lawmakers those investments could deliver big economic benefits.
Tom Atkinson runs the Kotzebue Electric Association in Alaska, a federal grant supposed to help the community pay for batteries to store electricity, cutting down how much diesel fuel has to be shipped in to run generators. But the money was frozen after President Trump took office, and the people in Atkinson's community are in a bind.
They just want the lights to go on. They want the rates to be affordable. We can't continue to do that without continued support.
Atkinson's one of dozens of leaders from rural communities who came to Washington looking for help. A spokesperson for Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said she's working on getting grants unfrozen. The Energy Department didn't respond to messages seeking comment. Michael Copley, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. A court in the United Arab Emirates has sentenced three people to death for the killing of an Israeli rabbi. NPR's Aya Batraoui tells us the court found the three guilty of premeditated murder.
The UAE state news agency did not include details on how or where in the country the rabbi was killed, or if it was politically motivated and related to Israel's ongoing war in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Israeli authorities have called it an anti-Semitic attack. The news agency says the verdicts can be appealed. The UAE had previously published the names and photos of three blindfolded and shackled men it said were behind the rabbi's killing. They all hail from Uzbekistan. Turkish authorities assisted the UAE in their arrest, reportedly after they'd fled to Turkey. The killing of Israeli Rabbi Zvi Kogan in November shocked the Jewish community in the UAE, which has grown and become more visible since the UAE and Israel established ties. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
U.S. businesses that rely on foreign factories, materials, as well as merchandise are worried about losing sales if they pass on the cost to consumers. This comes as President Trump levies new import tariffs tomorrow on foreign goods coming into the U.S. Some companies are retooling to reduce costs and avoid raising prices, while others are looking at modifying or slimming down their products, think shrinkflation, to save money. Stocks finished mixed after another shaky day on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
On a Tuesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Thousands of people were fired from the Department of Health and Human Services today. That affects medical research, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Those CDC cuts could affect the response to the measles outbreak that started in West Texas. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies is here to explain. Hi there.
Hey,
how could these CDC cuts affect efforts to address the measles outbreak in Texas?
Well, for an outbreak to come to an end, there should be three things: contact tracing, testing, and immunizations. The concern is that all of these will be reduced and the virus will continue to spread. Today, there was an update on the number of confirmed cases of measles in West Texas. It's grown to 422. Almost every person infected was unvaccinated. I spoke with Terry Burke, president of the Texas nonprofit, the Immunization Project. She said state health service funds are being lost, including for vaccination programs and for testing in the measles outbreak.
It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So the impact on the measles outbreak would seem to be substantive.
The Texas health officials released a statement saying the cancellation of the CDC grants has not impacted the state's response to the measles outbreak.
Seems contradictory there. So what happens when vaccination and testing programs are cut?
Well, we know the answer to that because this has happened before in the 1980s. The result was a national measles outbreak in 1989 with 123 deaths across the country. Dr. Adam Ratner is warning of a repeat. He's a pediatrician and the author of the new book, Booster Shots, The Urgent Lessons of Measles and the Uncertain Future of Children's Health.
What's happening in Texas now is a choice. The idea that we have had a child die from measles in the United States in 2025 is insane.
Ratner said the nation should be investing more in public health at this time and not less.
There's also a new concern with this outbreak where some children are being given toxic levels of vitamin A by their parents. Explain what's happening there.
Yeah, vitamin A. Last week, the hospital in Lubbock, the Covenant House, confirmed to me that children with measles complications are being admitted for treatment, and they are also having to be treated for overdoses of vitamin A, and that's caused liver problems for those children. Vitamin A in small doses is used as supportive care in measles outbreaks. Here's what Dr. David Higgins said about it. He's a practicing pediatrician and researcher at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus.
We know that if somebody is deficient in vitamin A, that can lead to worse outcomes. And it's for that reason that the World Health Organization, they recommend vitamin A supplementation for children with measles.
Misinformation has been spreading online that vitamin A can prevent measles, which it can't. It may be related to Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has a history of spreading medical misinformation about vaccines. He's been enthusiastically promoting the use of vitamin A to treat measles. He's even appeared on Fox News touting its benefits. But overuse of vitamin A does have those serious consequences. And again, I need to emphasize, the only thing that can prevent measles is that vaccine.
That's David Martin Davies of Texas Public Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Most days this year, the Justice Department has been busy defending President Trump's executive actions in courtrooms all over the country. In many of those cases, the government's own lawyers have been struggling to answer questions and having to correct the record. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson reports.
A perfect storm has been brewing inside the Justice Department this year. Start with dozens of executive orders raining down on the White House from day one.
There have been over 130 lawsuits that have been filed in the past 2 months, and that would be an extraordinary amount of litigation for DOJ to defend, even if it were fully staffed, which it is not, is far from it.
That's Kelsey Brown Corcoran. She spent 6 years at the Justice Department and now teaches at Georgetown University Law Center. Corcoran says the unit inside DOJ that defends the federal government has lost more than a third of its lawyers this year. Josh Blackman is a law professor at South Texas College of Law.
It's sort of well known that when Trump came into office, there were a number of people at DOJ who decided to step down. And even those who perhaps didn't choose to step down maybe were nudged out, as they might say. So I think they're dealing with fewer people willing to help with these cases.
That tight squeeze is leading to some mistakes. Last month, there was a typo on the first page of an appeals court brief signed by the attorney general and other top officials. Ryan Goodman of NYU Law School says he has a bigger concern. DOJ lawyers are unable or unwilling to answer questions from judges.
The Justice Department is fast losing credibility before the courts.
Goodman watches all these cases closely, starting with a challenge to Trump's order getting rid of birthright citizenship.
The first one that had a hearing with a Reagan-appointed judge in Seattle, he actually said to the lawyers, "Where were the lawyers in the room when you did this?"
That birthright citizenship order clashes with the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and a separate statute, and the judge wanted to know who signed off that the order was legal. The Justice Department office that usually does that review has been sidelined this year. Then, Goodman says, judges have had lots of questions about who's running DOGE, the team tied to Elon Musk that's been slashing federal agencies. One DOJ lawyer told a judge they didn't know.
It's not just like a fact. It's not a small detail. It is a knowable fact. And to me, that either suggests bad faith on the part of the Department of Justice or, and I think more likely, that they're not in the loop.
A spokesperson said vigorously defending President Trump's executive actions in federal court is a top priority for this Department of Justice. Josh Blackman says every day brings a fire drill of emergency litigation in the courts.
Usually there are these fairly intricate interagency communications where people from different departments will meet and discuss what's sort of going on.
But that normal process seems not to be happening, partly because of so many executive orders and so many lawsuits. Blackman says it's not fair to blame DOJ lawyers for not having some of those details.
These are sort of novel times. I think the government's lawyers are doing the best they can to deal with sort of this new paradigm that President Trump has brought in with his agenda, which is moving just very fast.
But in other cases, the Trump administration seems to be making a choice not to share information. Take the lawsuit about dozens of alleged Venezuelan gang members sent to a notorious prison in El Salvador last month. Lawyers for DOJ said they didn't know when the planes took off or when Trump signed the order. When the judge grew upset, the administration invoked state secrets to avoid answering the question. Again, Kelsey Corcoran.
That's not attorneys who are unprepared. That's a strategic decision that the government has made not to divulge information.
A decision, she says, will be tested by the courts. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Spring is busting out all over in the Northern Hemisphere, and in the Adirondack Mountains of New York, early spring is when different seasons mix and sometimes collide. NPR's Brian Mann and North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein found some bright sun and some old snow.
We set off mid-morning through a forest glowing with spring sun.
It is an insanely beautiful day, 65 degrees, sunny. What could be better?
David and I have been hiking together in these mountains in northern New York for a quarter century. Today, he's leaning into the promise that winter is done.
I'm wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and that's it. And I do have a Buffalo Bills little beanie.
I was going to make you mention the Buffalo Bills hat.
Go Bills.
Go Bills, yeah.
We trek on, climbing up winding trails that already smell warm of pine and trail dust. We rock hop across a stream gurgling with snowmelt. Spring means different things in different places. Here in the north, it means a lifting of darkness and cold that sometimes feel endless.
No matter how much you love winter, when you get these first days of warmth and being able to have your skin exposed to the air and not feel totally bitten, it's exhilarating.
It's warm enough. We sweat as we climb. We pass a stand of ferns, already luscious green. But there's also a fierce wind at times, especially when we're climbing on open rock.
As we keep on going up this ridge, it's just craggy and rocky and beautiful.
Below us, the forest moves like water as currents of wind sweep the valley. We climb on, going high enough, the patches of snow turn into deep drifts.
So we switched to snowshoes, which didn't feel like it at all when we were at the trailhead. But that's the thing about spring hiking and climbing, is that you'll go through multiple seasons in one hike.
This is one of those moments where I'm getting sunburned, walking on snow, kind of everything at once in spring.
We reach a big shelf of rock, sheltered a bit from the wind, where we can catch our breath and eat a picnic.
I fell up to my back in snow, so there is at least 3 feet.
As we dig into cheese sandwiches and hummus and big wedges of chocolate, I ask David if he's impatient with this mix of seasons, the sun and summery smells of sweat and dust, but also this mountain snow that hangs on.
You're seeing the earth change in real time, and it's really something special that you become a part of when you go on a hike like this. We're still kind of halfway in between.
As we eat, we watch the wind tumble clouds over the peaks. A moment later, it's sunny again. Full summer will come soon enough. For now, this changeable season feels exactly right. With David Summerstein, I'm Brian Mann, NPR News in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The world's youngest nation, South Sudan, could be on the brink of another civil war, according to the United Nations. At the heart of the tension is a power struggle between the country's president and vice president. Both leaders signed a peace agreement in 2018 to end that conflict, but many fear it could erupt again, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
A fragile peace was barely holding in South Sudan, and then came the trigger. In this footage broadcast by a local media channel, fighters from a loosely organized armed group called the White Army celebrated early last month after they attacked a military base and a UN helicopter trying to rescue soldiers there. The White Army is linked to Vice President Riek Machar, a longtime rival of President Salva Kiir. The militants were angry that the government deployed soldiers to Nasir County, their region in the east. A UN staff member and over 25 South Sudanese soldiers were killed. The attack provoked a swift response from the government.
Undeniably, the National Security Service has arrested and detained several individuals.
Within days, the National Security Spokesperson David John Kimuri said the Vice President and other government ministers had been put under house arrest, accused of being complicit in the attack. Last week, Machar was issued a formal arrest warrant. Neighboring Uganda's military deployed to South Sudan to support the army, who've responded with heavy force. Scores of people have been killed in Nasir County, including civilians, according to local civil groups. The clashes between the government and the White Army have ignited volatile ethnic tensions with other armed groups, including on the outskirts of the capital, Juba.
The current situation is extremely worrying.
Maduk Jok is a professor at Syracuse University, specializing in security, governance, and democracy.
It threatens plunging the country back into another civil war.
He said the seeds of the crisis were sown in the failures of the 2018 peace and power-sharing deal between Kiir, Machar, and other parties. President Kiir has been accused by the opposition of attempting to change the power-sharing agreement in his favor, but it has stoked tensions again between Kiir's dominant Dinka ethnic group and Machar's newer ethnicity. Compounding all of this, the country's oil revenues have been hit hard by the civil war in Sudan, the country it gained independence from in 2011.
This country has not seen rest, and it will probably not see rest so long as the current leadership remains locked into these violent confrontations over power and resources.
And so a country in perpetual tension is again on a knife edge. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
A 13-year-old boy is arrested for the alleged murder of a classmate, a girl. Soon enough, it becomes clear that what he has been looking at on his smartphone could be used to implicate him. Now, that is the premise of a new Netflix drama called Adolescence, which broke Netflix streaming records in March, in part because it raises really uncomfortable questions about the inner lives of teenage boys. But one viewer was Lisa Damore. She is also a clinical psychologist and author of the book The Emotional Lives of Teenagers. Lisa Damore, hi, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you specialize in kids this age, the age of Jamie, the main character. What struck you about how this show depicts boys of middle school age?
I think it is the most nuanced and complex portrait of middle school boys I've ever seen. It does an extraordinary job of laying bare all that they contend with in terms of feelings of shame and feelings of longing and also feelings of anger. And it also shows how boys are in our culture left feeling like they're not allowed to have a lot of vulnerable feelings. And so they are often instead showing all of their emotions through anger or pleasure at someone else's expense, which is something we've been able to document in the research. And then on top of that, this show depicts how that comes down to the main character through parenting, and also shows how having such a limited emotional repertoire creates fertile ground for misogynistic content that can be found online and comes through influencers like Andrew Tate and others.
Would you point us to a particular scene where what you're talking about is in evidence, a scene that you found particularly striking in the depiction of early teen boys?
There's one long extended scene where he is interviewed by a very skilled psychologist. And in the scene, you see moments where she very, very adeptly starts to move towards experiences that were very painful for him and very shameful for him. And then, you know, in a really quite remarkable piece of acting and writing, he becomes explosively rageful and scary and threatening.
Jamie, if you do not sit
down... Look, sit down! You do not tell me when to sit down! You do not control my... Look at me now!
And it's as apt and nuanced a depiction of how, for so many boys and men, they may get close to feelings that make them feel vulnerable, and then they don't know what to do and move back into the feelings that are most acceptable for them and probably more comfortable for them, which are to act out or to attack others.
I know that you tackle some of the issues raised by the show in a podcast that you co-host, the Ask Lisa podcast. And this week's episode, you're talking about adolescence, the show, and the role that families can play, that society plays in influencing boys. Tell us about the conversation that you wanted to have there.
Well, this show, as much as it's about Jamie, I think it's also about his dad. The show does an incredible job of telling the father's story and telling what he himself went through as a child, how he's tried to be better as a father himself, and yet how he struggles with his own emotions and doesn't have nearly the facility with emotions that we would want him to have. And one of the things that we know from the research is that boys learn about handling their feelings from watching the men around them handle their feelings. And one particular challenge is that, especially around elementary school, middle school, as boys are trying to figure out what it means to be masculine, a lot of them come to the conclusion that feelings are for girls. And then we see in the research that in two-parent heterosexual homes, the person most likely to be talking about feelings is usually the mom, which unfortunately can have the effect of proving the boy's point. So one of the things that I took away from the research and took away again from watching adolescents is that if we want boys to develop more emotional facility, especially around vulnerable emotions, it's the men in their lives who need to be modeling this and showing them how it's done.
Psychologist Lisa DeMoor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR.
Well, I'm going home. Going home. Going home. Going home. Yeah, I know. I